The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Explores, time traveling through history, one era at a time. I'm Kate Armstrong. Last week, we left off talking about where Egyptian women got so much legal power from, and discussing how the goddess Isis put her husband back together for one last roll in the hay. But when we're not divorcing our husbands, what are we doing with our days, work-wise? What are we eating when we're in need of sustenance? How do we know what kind of fork to use at that fancy feast? Hint, there are none. Let's resume our lives in the New Kingdom during the 18th dynasty, shall we? Grab your wig, your favorite amulet, and some cedar perfume. Let's go traveling. But first, a shout out to my patrons. My pirate queens, Emily, Get Grim Podcast, and Jessica B. And my lady presidents, Edie, Alexis, Ashley, Brendan, Amy, Avery, Jordan, Caroline, Cassie, Claire, Courtney, Debbie, Elizabeth, Ellie, Eve, Jackie, Jessica S., Caitlin, Karen, Casey, Kat, Catherine, Louisa, Lindsay, Mary, Meg, Nancy, Pamela, Paul, Sasha, and Townsend. If you dig the Explores, becoming a patron for as little as $1 a month really helps keep the show going. Plus, it gives you access to exclusive bonus episodes, sneak peeks, and more. To check it out, go to my website and click on Become a Patron. My gratitude is endless. As farm gals, we'll likely be very busy preparing meals, brewing beer, looking after the kids, and cleaning. Cleaning. But we won't be doing any laundry. Apparently, that's a man's job. Yes, honey! A few hot tips from ye olde Egyptian papyrus scrolls. Natron, which we bathed with, is very good for cleaning. The fat of an oriole is good for getting rid of flies, and the fat of a cat helps clear the house of mice. I'd have thought a living cat might be better, but you do you. We'll be working out in the fields during harvest time, so keep your eye out for those 18-foot crocodiles. Some women step in to manage their husband's affairs when he's away, making sure the farm keeps running and working that account book. Regardless, it ain't an easy life. No one's gonna fan you with palm fronds and hand you lemonade when you get tired. For the huge Egyptian workforce, there is no 8-hour workday, and much like Dame Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey, we are not familiar with the term weekend. Some credit the Egyptians with giving us the 365-day calendar. 360 of those days are for work, with 5 left over for religious festivals. A brutal schedule that America is still more or less clinging to. The higher class we are, the more likely we are to venture into other occupations. And unlike the ladies in 19th century America, women are well accounted for in the Egyptian public sphere. The top 5 jobs for women are priestess, midwife, professional mourner, entertainer, and weaver. The pharaoh, which actually doesn't translate as king, but as a great house, is at the very tippy top of the power pyramid. He, or sometimes she, is a direct descendant of the gods, the living link between the gods and us. He protects the people, makes sure the Nile floods, brings the sun up in the morning and the moon up at night. He is our chief priest always, but there are a lot of gods to honor, many temples to maintain, and rituals to stage, and he has a country to see to. That's where the priestly class comes in. We regular Josephines are very involved with our gods, but we're not going to temples to pray to them. Such places are reserved for priests. These positions are often privileged, lucrative, and powerful, and often come with their own estates. But we find women here too, serving as priestesses. And unlike in other empires, you need not be a virgin to apply. Temples are considered the gods' actual houses, and their statues are treated like the living deity. He or she is invited into their statue every morning. When they wake up, they're given breakfast, fed regular meals and prayers throughout the day. All of their needs are taken care of, even the sexual ones. Take the god Amun. Every day, his high priestess has the task of exciting her lord with dance and song and who knows what else, to be honest. These statues, by the way, are often carved with huge erections. How does one satisfy a giant statue? Your guess is as good as mine. But the gods don't always stay in their temples, hidden away from prying eyes. On festival days, they are put onto barks or long barges and taken across the Nile to special locations for celebration and worship. I dread having to lift my chest of drawers when I move houses. Imagine trying to move a huge marble Isis. Girl, you're a goddess! Get up and walk! Priestesses are close to the gods, which gives them proximity to the pharaoh. They can also read and write. Egyptians have a beautiful written language in the form of hieroglyphs. We basically invented paper, made by smashing layers of papyrus flat and stitching them together into long scrolls. Papyrus is where we get the word paper from, so, you know, kind of a major invention. Writing is considered a sacred art. If you write something down, it's more likely to come true. Young men are pushed to learn to write, as that will give them a chance to become official scribes. But most people can't. Some estimates have it at 2% of the population. And it doesn't seem as if many of those are women. We know that the wives of artisans and men of learning write letters back and forth with their husbands, but other than some royal women, not many become official scribes. At least if tomb walls have anything to say about it. But there are exceptions, probably more than we know. After all, there is a goddess of scribes. Her name is Seshet. She's usually to be found wearing a leopard skin and a 7-pointed star headdress, winning her Best Dressed Goddess of Egypt. She's in charge of record keeping and is the chief librarian at the Per Ankh, or House of Life. A kind of library/university/publishing center, where doctors and scribes go when they need to do some learning. And while they may not do it in huge numbers, we know that women roam its halls as well. Most doctors come from the priestly class and are men, but not all. The first Egyptian female physician of record is Merit-Pah, who lived around 2700 BCE, toward the end of the early dynastic period. An inscription on a tomb at Saqqara named her chief physician, so she would have been supervising male underlings and attending to the king. Yeah, she did. Another early doctor named Peseshet lived around 2500 BCE, when the Great Pyramids were being built. Her title was Lady Overseer of Female Physicians, and she may have taught future doctors at the temple school at Sais. I can just see her now chastising her students.
Oh no, no, you don't put that in there.
This is super progressive for the ancient world. When a 4th century Greek woman named Agna Dicey wants to study medicine, she has to smuggle herself into Egypt's Alexandria to do it, then goes back home to tend to lady patients illegally. What a stone-cold badass. When it comes to delivering babies, it's mostly women who serve as midwives and wet nurses. In the New Kingdom, where we're currently residing, royal wet nurses have a lot of power. Not surprising, given that they're the ones nurturing tiny pharaohs. Some of them have so much power that diplomatic men want to marry them just to get ahead in politics. In several centuries, in Cleopatra's sparkling city of Alexandria, we'll see female lecturers take up residence among their male counterparts. We even see them take up high public offices, like treasurer, judge, and vizier, a kind of prime minister, which is one of the highest positions you can get after the pharaoh. And then, of course, there are our queens and female pharaohs. The dynasty we're currently in the middle of will give us two of them. But we'll hang with those lady bosses a little bit later. A little further down the working ladies' totem pole, we have weavers. Weaving textiles is a female-dominated profession, and often fully women-run. In our current time period, several ladies are overseeing a team of weavers at the Temple of Amun at Karnak. The royal harem has a stake in the industry too, training and supervising textile workers, and sometimes even joining in to do some weaving of their own. Another super fun and potentially lucrative job for women is being a professional mourner. The Egyptians make an epic deal out of funerals, the idea being that the more people you have wailing and moaning over you, the more important you're going to seem. Apparently, overt and public grieving is primarily a woman's business. So families of means pay women to make a show of grieving for the 70 days it takes to mummify a body. This will involve tearing your clothes, ripping at your cheeks, much wailing, and throwing dust over your head. The more drama, the better. Women also serve as professional dancers and musicians. Some are employed at temples, doing special sexy dances for the gods. Others are good enough at both singing and dancing to earn the title Ornament of the King. Only women dance at fancy banquets, which they do wearing the ancient Egyptian version of a thong, bending themselves into all sorts of twisty positions. This sounds a bit concubine-y, to be sure. But these women often have influence and take an active part in royal functions, state events, and religious ceremonies. Musicians are an important part of religious rituals and celebrations, playing everything from the lyre to the sistrum, a kind of ancient rattle, to welcome a god into his temple or a king into his hall. Women are also doing manual labor outside of farming. One tomb painting shows a woman steering a cargo ship. When the man who brings her meals gets in her way, she shouts, rather gloriously,
"Don't obstruct my face while I am putting to shore!"
Boy, bye! For our work, we'll be paid not in coins. We'll have no monetary system until the Romans come calling, but rather in barter. Value is calculated in deben, or about 90 grams of copper, and everything is given and taken in trade. Oil, wheat, and barley are all popular things to trade for. A few bushels of wheat for that pair of golden earrings? Don't mind if I do! Of course, it's not all work and no play in ancient Egypt. While their elaborate tombs and pyramids give the impression they're obsessed with death, what they actually show us is a real zest for life. They fish, hunt, and sail. Ancient Egyptians are keen water sports enthusiasts, fond of doing something that sounds to me a little like Olympic kayaking, and pretty much as terrifying. As Roman philosopher Seneca wrote,
"The people embark on small boats, two to a boat, and one rows while the other bails out water. Then they're violently tossed about in the raging rapids. At length, they reach the narrowest channels, and swept along by the whole force of the river, they control the rushing boat by hand, and plunge head downward, to the great terror of the onlookers."
We also play music for fun, using harps, reed pipes, drums, you name it. And we play some of the same games as we do in our century. For instance, that old color day favorite, tug of war. One tomb painting displays a bunch of guys mid-tug, with the words,
"Your arm is stronger than his! Don't give in to him!"
beside it. There's also wrestling, juggling, and bowling, which Egypt invented. Though it's hard to say how many women are getting into it. Board games are particularly popular with everyone. Take the game called Senet, which features in many illustrations of royal women. We don't quite know how it's played, so I can't advise you. But it looks a lot like Go, so just start moving pieces around until someone yells at you. If we are an upper-class lady, we might pass the time with a stroll in carefully tended gardens. We might even go on a river cruise up the Nile. Our gal Cleopatra will later do this with the studly statesman Julius Caesar, creating quite the scandal. Though, as a rule, Egyptians don't travel outside of their country's borders just for funsies. You might die in a foreign land, and really, why leave when home's got everything you need? And then, of course, there are feasts. Ah, feasts. Let's go to one. Make sure you're dripping head-to-toe gold, and lock your door behind you. We invented the door lock, you know, so we might as well use it. And let's head over to our friend's place for dinner. As farm girls, we might walk or travel by riverboat. As fancy ladies, we might get our servants to take us via carrying chair. Or, my favorite, we might drive our own chariots, introduced to Egypt by the Hyksos not long ago. Mush, greyhounds! So here we are, at a fancy feast in someone's fancy palace, wearing a killer cat eye and a see-through mesh bead dress. Owning it! Let's soak in the majesty, shall we? We're sitting on the floor around a long table, or we might be on low chairs or stools. There's likely to be a little bowl to wash your hands in. And since we want to make sure you're smelling your best, we might hold a lotus flower in one of our hands. If that gets a little awkward, you might even mix a little bit of that lotus in your wine, though it's mildly hallucinogenic, so, you know, I wouldn't recommend it. But we'll also take things a step further in the perfume department by putting a cone of incense-infused fat on our heads. There it will warm and drip, releasing its scent throughout the evening. How we keep said fat out of our cat eye makeup, I'm not sure. The most popular incense for such occasions is frankincense, a resin from trees that grow only in Arabia and Somalia. There's a reason a king will one day give some to Jesus. It's very valuable stuff. Pharaohs make special expeditions to a magical land called Punt, somewhere near present-day Ethiopia, to get it. Myrrh as well. Dancers will probably come in, mostly naked, and twist themselves into some attractive knots. Musicians are also likely to play, setting the mood for debauchery. In Cleopatra's day, during the Ptolemaic era, things will get extra fancy. Floors covered in flowers, looking like an indoor meadow, because queen! Rose flower crowns are made for every guest, sprinkled with cinnamon and balsam and cardamom. They keep us smelling fresh, and apparently their scent also keeps us from getting too drunk, which is good because we have a lot of alcoholic beverages to choose from. The staples of our diet, no matter our class, are beer and bread, so you'd best not have a gluten allergy. They spring from the same process. Once dough has been mixed and shaped into loaves, it's left to rise. If we want bread, we'll pop the pans into the oven, and when we want beer, we'll crumble them into water, make a mash, and let it sit for a bit until it's fermented. Then we'll strain the stuff into jars, and hello, beer! This is all wild yeast we're using, so the final product is likely to be funky. If, like me, you're a hoppy IPA fan, you're destined for disappointment. Hops won't make their way into beer for a very long time. The Greeks and Romans looked down on this tasty beverage, but we're generally huge fans. Some claim the Egyptians invented beer, but it's more accurate to say that they invented the first beer we time travelers might recognize. And it's irrevocably tied to the ladies, because brewing is considered a domestic activity, and that means brewing is a woman's domain. In fact, the Egyptian god of beer is a woman named Tenenet. For most of history, brewing was very much a woman's game. How about you tell that to your bearded flannel-wearing friend next dinner party? It's a staple of the working class. The guys who built the pyramids were paid for their labor in beer. Doctors dole it out as medicine for its ability to confuse evil spirits and because of how it gladdens the heart. As farm gals, we'll drink it every day because something's got to make our lives more bearable. Just kidding. It's because the brewing process purifies our water, making it safe for us to drink. Though we ancient ladies probably don't understand it as such. Plus, it's nutritious. We use lots of whole grains in the brewing process, and unlike most of today's beer, it's thick, cloudy, and unfiltered. So we'll often drink it through long straws, sharing vessels with friends like you might with one of those giant fishbowl cocktails you'll find on the glittery streets of New Orleans. Sole consumption? Not advised. Beer is drunk everywhere. Farmhouses and palaces, during rituals and at great feasts. King Tut's famous tomb contained several jars of the stuff to see him through the afterlife. We might add some date juice to sweeten it, or some red dye if it's a holiday. It's usually around 3 or 4% alcohol, which is fairly sessionable. For festivals and rituals, it's more like 7%, so take care. There's a reason that Sekhmet, our lion-headed man-eater goddess, is called the Lady of Drunkenness. As the scribe Ani wrote,
"Boast not that you can drink a jug of beer. You speak, and an unintelligible utterance issues from your mouth. You are found lying on the ground, and you are like a child."
True that, Ani. Happens to the best of us. Well-to-do Egyptians think it's a peasant drink, so they tend to reach for their sweet wines, which they make with the tried-and-true barefoot stomping method. And we love it. So what are we soaking up all this beer with? Bread and bread and so much bread. It's at every meal, stuffed into meat, served with sweet honey. In terms of protein, as wealthier ladies, we're most likely to consume red meat fairly often, plus pork and lamb, which we've domesticated, along with things like oryx and gazelle. Mmm, gamey. There are geese and ducks, too, and if we're feeling fancy, maybe even some roasted peacock. The Nile provides plenty of fish for our feast as well. Though, hopefully we aren't eating the crocodiles. I've had croc carpaccio, and let me tell ya, bleh. You'll have access to a range of lovely spices that we still use. Coriander, rosemary, parsley, and fenugreek. You'll have salt too, of course, but no pepper. Not until the Romans come a-calling. For the farm gal at home, a mainstay is legumes, and luckily we're all eating plenty of veggies. Onions, garlic, leeks, squash, cucumbers, celery, radishes. Lettuce is considered the go-to food if you want an aphrodisiac. In terms of dairy, there will be a bit of cheese thrown in for good measure and some milk. So far, it's sounding better than the Victorian-era diet. Grab a spoon by all means, but if you're looking for a fork on the table, don't bother. There's the two-tined variety to spear meat with and cook with, but we won't be using them for eating for quite a while to come. Your fingers are plenty good enough, don't you agree? If you're in the mood for something sweet, there's fruit. Dates, grapes, melons, pomegranates, and honey. No sugar, I'm afraid, but let's be honest, that's probably for the best. A tomb in Luxor offers up a recipe for a cake made with tiger nuts. We don't have any chocolate, but we do have carob, that chocolate-like seed pod that, back in our century, you'll find in your closest expensive health food shop. Egyptian carob pudding, anyone? While intoxication may not be encouraged, the Egyptians really know how to party. According to one tomb painting, one female partygoer asked for
18 cups of wine, for my insides are as dry as straw.
Oh my, somebody's gonna have a hangover tomorrow. And why not? With the average lifespan sitting around 40 years old, with 50 considered practically decrepit, we'd better make hay while the sun still shines. Feeling a bit raw the morning after? Maybe it's time to take one of your 3 times monthly purgatives, using castor oil to clean out your intestines. While we're at it, let's talk about what medicine might be available to us. And let's talk about childbirth, and how we might be trying to keep pregnancy at bay. Though the Egyptians know an awful lot about our bodies and how they work, for an ancient civilization, this life isn't easy. Particularly on our teeth. Part of the problem are the stones we're using to grind grains for bread, which has us eating more sand and grit than is good for us. It wears down our tooth enamel, exposing the pulp of the tooth and making it vulnerable to infection. Eau de mouth decay is a major problem, so we've invented the world's first breath mints, made from frankincense, myrrh, and cinnamon boiled with honey and shaped into pellets. Though it doesn't solve the basic problem. A couple of common diseases are schistosomiasis, try saying that 3 times fast. This involves teeny tiny waterborne worms that get into your feet, crawl on up into your bladder and onto your rectum, and there start laying eggs. Don't be alarmed if you start peeing blood. Or be alarmed, I guess, and hurry on back to the future for treatment. Tuberculosis and lung problems are also fairly prevalent, given how much sand we're breathing in. You'd think we would have learned a lot from the practice of embalming, but apparently the guys getting us ready for the afterlife aren't doctors, and don't treat their work as a means of studying the body. Doctors have learned what they know from studying animals, which means that they still know very little about how our internal organs work. Generally, we'll be treated at home, but since many doctors are priests as well, we may have to venture to a temple. These doctors will do you a real historical solid by attending to you with clean hands, and they're likely to be a specialist in something. There are even proctologists, whose name literally translates to
Shepherd of the Anus.
Though, to be fair, they're dealing with more than your posterior. Pretty much anything happening below your belly button. We have two means of approaching medical concerns, clinical and magical. If you've got a crocodile bite, say, you're probably dead. But if you're not, we'll just sew the wound closed and then put raw meat over it. Clinical. But if we have a fever and don't know the cause, we might assume the problem is demons and treat it with a magical spell. Crushed forehead? Let's make a poultice of grease and ostrich egg and say a quick spell. We'll see how that goes. There are several specifically medical papyri floating around, and many of their suggested remedies are woman-specific. If Tom Hiddleston is keen to know if you're going to be good at childbearing, we'll sit over a bowl full of beer and dates and wait to see how many times we throw up from the fumes. Each time we puke equals one future child. Of course it does. Or you could go ahead and stick an onion into your cervix area. If your breath smells like onions the next day, you're good to go. For those of us already mothers, the Papyrus Ebers prescribes a potion with opium in it to stop a baby's crying, which, as Harriet Tubman taught us, is likely to do the trick. For the woman in labor, let's rub peppermint oil on your posterior. I'm not sure exactly how that's supposed to help you, but you're sure to smell great while breathing through your pain. Most medicines involve some combination of milk, beer, oil, honey, fruit, and spices. The Egyptians practice an early form of homeopathy, the idea that the loss of one thing can be fixed by adding in something like it. We know of several instances where small children ate skinned mice not long before death because of this principle. Because the Nile gives life, and these mice appear miraculously out of the mud every year when the water recedes. They're full of life, so maybe they'll be able to grant it. This applies to less depressing cases, too. For instance, a mandrake root looks pretty phallic, so it's given to men with erectile dysfunction. Never mind that eating too much of it might make you go insane. The Edwin Smith Surgical Papyrus, as it's known, goes into quite a lot of detail about how to treat ailments ranging from a wound on the top of the eyebrow to things like tumors of the breast. Hint, there's no cure for that one. It's mostly there to keep doctors from being sued. There's even a remedy called
How to Transform an Old Man into a Youth,
which details how to make a wrinkle cream out of a fruit called the hemayet. In an early form of promissory advertising, it assures us that
it has been shown effective millions of times.
If you listened to last season's bonus episode on female hysteria, which I recommend highly, you'll remember that the Egyptians knew all about it. This ladies-only disease that turns us into crazy balls of emotions comes from our womb's tendency to go a-wandering. To fix it, you'll coax it back into place by putting good-smelling things near your mouth or lady region, depending on which way the womb has wandered. The theory is that it'll corral your queen back into the lady palace and into its proper place to ease your crazy. Thousands of years from now, we'll give 19th century women smelling salts working on this very same theory. So, let's say things got a little wilder at last night's banquet than you'd hoped. Hands to yourself, Tom. What are we doing about contraception? The Cahoon Medical Papyrus has a few ideas, and none of them are going to fill you with joy. You might start by praying to a particular deity for help in this arena. The crocodile is associated with abortion, the hippo with pregnancy, and wearing their amulets might help you along your chosen path. But for those not wanting to take any chances, there are treatments both magical and botanical. For starters, you might attach a cat's liver to your left foot, or enjoy a potion of mule kidney and eunuch's urine. Good luck choking that one down. A spider's egg attached with a deer hide before sunrise is as good as a 12-month subscription to the pill. Early diaphragms involve wool moistened with honey and oil. But a traditional mixture of salt, mouse poop, honey, and resin? I'm not so sure about that one. For a morning after pill, try white poplar, juniper berries, or silphium. This fennel-like plant's dark seeds have the power to ease your bloated tummy, spice up a meal, perfume your body, and prevent pregnancy if you drink its juice once a month. You could also soak a rag with it and, well, you know where that thing's gotta go. Other things you might stick into your lady place: a mixture of unripe acacia fruit, honey, colocynth, or bitter apple, and ground dates. Acacia ferments into lactic acid, which can actually act as a spermicide. We might also use crocodile poop to prevent pregnancy. Yes. A medical papyrus from 1850 BCE assures us that
crocodile dung mixed with honey and placed in the vagina of a woman prevents conception.
After mixing the feces with fermented dough, we're supposed to sprinkle it on or inside to stop sperm in their tracks. How delightful! Some researchers think the alkaline nature of this ingredient could achieve that aim, while others think maybe not. Me, I think it sounds like a recipe for a yeast infection. Regardless of whether you're excited to get pregnant or trying not to, you're in luck. The Egyptians have come up with the first urine-based pregnancy test. We'll pee on two patches of emmer wheat and barley seeds over the course of several days, and
if the barley grows, it means a male child. If the wheat grows, it means a female child. If both do not grow, she will not bear at all.
Modern-day tests suggest the results are fairly accurate, say 70% accurate. Well, all right, ancient Egypt. We won't be going to the temple to have our babies. Instead, we'll be delivering at home, relying on other women and midwives, and we'll do it squatting, sitting in our own little birthing stool. It'll be made of bricks, which is why Egyptians sometimes call giving birth sitting on the bricks. We're likely to do a whole lot of praying during this time, as childbirth is dangerous for us and for our babies. Child mortality is high, maybe as high as 50%. This is the price of living in the ancient world. Of course, we can't spend time in ancient Egypt without talking about death. Or rather, our quest to keep the party going after we pass out of the mortal realm, which requires quite a bit of ritual doing. When we die, our family will ferry our body over the Nile. We might even hire female mourners to travel with us, weeping and wailing to show how much we'll be missed. Long before sarcophagi, we buried our dead in the sand. But no one likes their loved ones eaten by jackals, so in 2700 BCE, a pharaoh named Zoser took a bunch of mastabas, adobe rectangles, and stacked them on top of each other to make a step pyramid, one of the first. After that, the push was on to create ever higher pyramids to encase the dead in. They're the tallest structures in the ancient world, and won't be bested in height until the Eiffel Tower. How they built the Great Pyramids at Giza is a bit of a mystery. Khufu's 480-foot pyramid has 2 million blocks, all weighing some 60 tons, which workers had to find some way to lift and move into place. Woof. They're a perfect symbol for how seriously Egyptians take the afterlife. It isn't heaven. It is essentially a different plane, just like Earth, except that it goes on forever. In the beginning, only kings could reach it, but now everyone has a chance. If you can afford mummification, a funeral, and a set of funerary texts. We have three spirits: the Ankh, the immortality of the deceased, tends to start out trapped in the body, so text and paintings on tomb walls will help remind it where it needs to go. Your other two spirits, the Ba, or personality, and Ka, or life force, will make camp closer to the corpse, so they'll need supplies to keep them going. That's why tombs are filled with the kinds of things you'd need for a long-term glamping trip: food, drink, clothes, jewels, furniture, wives, servants, even your favorite dogs. But they're also filled with spells and stories, tales of your greatness and what you hope your afterlife will be. To make it on this perilous journey, we need to preserve our vessel. It's pretty ingenious, this way we've figured out of removing the organs from the body, packed in some natron to dry out, much like you'd use salt to shrivel a slug. Then you put them aside in Coptic jars. The heart stays in, as it's considered important, but the embalmer doesn't think you need your brain. That, he'll pull out your nose with a tiny hook. Ugh. We'll be washed with palm wine and packed with sawdust and resin-soaked balls of linen, anointed with oils, and wrapped with strips of our own bedding. The wrapping process alone takes upwards of 20 days. You'll be given a shroud and a death mask and put in a sarcophagus. This attention to detail means some future British archaeologist will have the fine opportunity to stare into our preserved, not quite as beautiful faces thousands of years from now. Though not all mummified bodies will be so lucky. Some will be uncovered and moved by tomb robbers. Others will be ground up to make a popular pre-Raphaelite paint color called mummy brown.
Hey Giuseppe, could you pass me the ground human remains? It does amazing things for my portraits of Jesus.
Gross. When an artist named Edward Burne Jones learns that one of his favorite mixers is actually made up of long dead body, he grabs his final tube, digs a little hole in his yard, and gives it a proper burial. Good on ya, Edward. But the paint won't fade out of the artistic scene until the 1960s, when paint makers will run out of the stuff and their access to mummies. Ah, those were the good old days. From there, the soul goes on an epic adventure. You're gonna have to work for that sweet place beside the gods. Once you reach the Hall of Judgment, you'll stand before the 42 divine judges and explain away any mistakes you made in life. Then you'll have your heart weighed against the feather of the goddess Maat, as that'll tell us if you've been virtuous. Worried about the weight of your heart? The Book of the Dead left in your tomb is like a handy afterlife cheat sheet, filled with 400 spells you can recite in moments just like these. But if you've been too naughty, Amit the Devourer, a woman, of course, might eat it, condemning you to eternal darkness. She is terrifying, part croc, part lion, part hippo. Get it, Amit? If you prove worthy, you'll go before Osiris and be welcomed into the afterlife. This'll involve a lake, some boating, and then finally setting into your new plot of land in the Field of Reeds. Woo! That was more epic than Lord of the Rings, but with fewer hobbits. The ancient Egyptians were obsessed with life, not death, with the ability to feast, love, and be merry. They glimmered with jewels, held larger-than-life festivals, loved a drink and a hearty laugh. So as we walk across these eternal midnight fields, let's linger over the poem someone's written on our tomb wall.
So seize the day, hold holiday, be unwearied, unceasing, alive, you and your own true love. Let not the heart be troubled during your sojourn on earth, but seize the day as it passes.
Next week, we're going to explore the lives and times of some of the most powerful women in the ancient world, Egypt's queens and lady pharaohs. We'll walk with them through the gilded halls of their palaces and into the shady dens of royal harems, exploring what life was like at the top and how, amidst a patriarchal system, they found a way to rule the world. Until next time. Thanks for listening. If you're a fan, consider becoming a patron. You'll help keep the show going and get access to exclusive bonus content, sneak peeks, and more. Just go to my website and click on Become a Patron. While you're there, check out the transcript for this episode, which includes the lady-centric timeline and special map I mentioned, plus a list of my research sources, music credits, and a ton of amazing images. Just go to www.theexplorespodcast.com. Speaking of images, come find me on Instagram at the Explores Podcast, or come play with me on Facebook or Twitter at the Explores Pod. With any questions or suggestions, just shoot me an email. I love hearing from you. A big thanks to the artists who graciously let me use their music in this episode, Keith Zizza and Derek and Brandon Fischer. For links to their work, check out the show notes. Much love, as always, to Mr. Explores, aka Paul Gablonski, for my theme music and logo and the amazing map and timeline of ancient Egypt made especially for season 2. And thanks to the following legends for their vocal stylings: Phil Chevalier, Andrew Goldman, Nancy Wassner, Edie Chevalier, thanks Mom, and Ray Reynolds from the Woman Splaining Podcast.